It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and good day to you on this Election Day 2018, an election that could see the highest turnout for a midterm since the mid-1960s. By the end of the day, people saying we could see 45 to 50% of eligible voters casting ballots. Normally by midterms, that's in the, 30 to 40% range. If we do see something of 45 to 50%, that would be a level not seen since 1970, when 47% of voters turned out, or 1966, when a record 49% turned out in a midterm. Joining us this hour with a historical look back at midterm elections, Tim Walsh, presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
Carrie Covington joining us by phone, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Carrie, so good to have you.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Let's talk first of all about, Tim, let me ask you, generally speaking, midterm elections, have they always throughout U.S. history held the gravitas that we have certainly today, but have they always meant the same thing throughout the history?
I'm not sure that the framers had the intent of serving, using the by-elections or the election between the presidential terms as a referendum on the president. But in fact, what happened, and certainly beginning with the election of 1824, we've seen that election following the presidential election as a way to assess how the president is doing, how his party is doing. Now, we're electing members of the House of Representatives. We're electing a third of the Senate. But back in 1824, no one's alive, of course, to remember this, we elected. In fact, Andrew Jackson received a plurality, both the popular vote and the electoral vote. But the election was thrown into the House of Representatives because there were three candidates, Henry Clay, John Quincy Adams, and Jackson. Through a corrupt bargain, as Jackson called it, Adams was selected by the House of Representatives as president. We've never done this since then. Jackson, for the next 2 years, and Jackson's men agitated against this corrupt bargain. So in 1826, you have that first agitated midterm election that effectively shut down the Adams presidency. And then, of course, in 1828, Jackson wins the presidency, defeating Adams. So you have, beginning in 1826, an effort to assess the presidential administration of the previous election.
Mm-hmm. Carrie Covington, what is your sense on when we get a sort of a modern sense of the emphasis on midterm elections as we have colored by today's standards?
Well, probably since Franklin Roosevelt, presidents since Roosevelt have taken center stage and therefore become the kind of prism through which voters view their congressional election in an off-year election.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to the middle of the 20th century. Before that, I want to remind our listeners, join our conversation. You have questions about midterms in history or observations about midterms in historical perspective, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You talked about Roosevelt. Before we jump into the 1950s, let's do talk about Roosevelt. Tim Walsh, the longest-serving president, right?
Absolutely, 12 years. What's interesting, too, about Roosevelt is that his first by-election or first midterm election, 1934, he gained 71 seats in the House of Representatives. That's very unusual. Since 1826, we've only had three elections where the president in office has gained seats in the House of Representatives, one of which, of course, was 1934. Another was 1998, completely mystifying me, which was the second Clinton midterm election. And then 2002, which was the election following 9/11, and the Bush administration gained seats in the House of Representatives. So in general, what you have interesting about Roosevelt is that gain of 71 seats, but then in 1938, in 1934, he gained 9 seats, but then he lost seats in 38.
Yeah, but in 34, is it the collective relief of the nation that the country wasn't going down the drain in the Great Depression?
I think there's no question that it was something of a national report card. I don't think it was shaped that way or phrased that way. But I do think the idea was that he'd been elected in 32. He had brought hope to the nation. We had 100 days of real active legislation. We had the National Recovery Act and so forth. And so what you have in 34 is a reaffirmation of that. Mm-hmm. And then 38, of course, I think it was a misstep, perhaps partly the decision to pack the Supreme Court, but also the economy, I think, had taken a dip down. And people were agitating against that.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump into the 1950 midterms. Have you comment after we hear a little bit of some TV news footage from the 1950 midterm elections taking place during the Korean War, during Democrat President Harry S. Truman's second term.
But it's in Ohio that the election story reaches its climax as Senator Robert A. Taft, often called Mr. Republican, submits his fate to the polls. Despite an all-out effort by labor to defeat him, he wins by an overwhelming 400,000. As the election results start rolling in, Mr. Republican and his party have every right to smile, gaining over 30 seats in the House and cutting the Democrats to a slim 2-vote Senate margin as the GOP surges back at the polls.
Why don't we use that expression anymore, Mr. Republican?
That was Robert Taft. He was known as Mr. Republican and hoped to win the nomination for president in 1952, and he got steamrolled by the Eisenhower train.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about this midterm.
In 1950, I think what you have is of course, a surprising election in 1948. Harry Truman wins the closest of presidential elections.
Dewey defeats Truman.
No, that's right. And so, once again, you have that sort of effort on the part of the American people to assess how was Truman doing. You also have the Korean War. So there's general dissatisfaction. And I think there was a kind of a weariness with a Democratic administration. So I think there was beginning in 1950. In fact, though Truman ran against a do-nothing Congress, the 1946 Congress, when he ran in 1948. So there's been something always of a foil. If the party out of the White House takes over, then the president will run against that party in his next effort to win the presidency. So you get it going back and forth, back and forth. It's a little bit of like political combat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kerry Covington, do you look back to the 1950s for a particular midterm that jumps out at you?
Well, the election that to me made a difference was the 58 midterm for Eisenhower, the last midterm of his presidency. And you saw a sweeping Democratic victory. They won like 48 seats in the House. And what it does is it lays the groundwork for the social activism and liberalism that comes in the 60s. And then when you compound that with what happened in 1964, which wasn't a midterm election but was rather a landslide presidential election, you create a Congress where the Democrats have such a huge majority that they're able to pass social legislation, civil rights legislation that Southern Democrats up to that time had been able to stymie.
Mm-hmm. And it's in the late 1950s that you have a then young, charming senator from Massachusetts even coming to Iowa in the lead up to the 1960 election, right, Kerry?
Could very well be.
In fact, the reason I mention this is we have a colleague at Iowa Public Radio, Dean Borg, known to all of us, who actually met then Senator Kennedy in Iowa in the late 1950s.
And no doubt he was laying the groundwork in 58. That was a reelection year for him in Massachusetts. He was laying the groundwork to run for the presidency. It was a very calculated effort on the part of his father and his whole family as to whether or not he could win the nomination in 1960. But I'd be curious, and maybe Kerry has any sense of this, Eisenhower lost 48 seats. Or let's put it this way. There was a change of 48 seats in the House of Representatives in 1958. And yet Eisenhower, generally speaking, is considered one of the near great presidents. And I think these people, the American people, still really loved Ike. But in 58, they smacked him on the nose. And I can't. So presidential popularity does not seem to be a predictor of how the House of Representatives will be changed.
Well, yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, there's a lot of things going on. Midterm elections tend to be base elections in the sense, what I mean by that is voters return to their base party affiliation. In presidential elections, especially when you go back to the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you have voters who are not voting a straight party ticket all the time. And in a presidential election, you draw in voters who don't vote in the midterm election. And so one party can do better in a presidential year and then recede in a off-term year. And I think by 1958, you've got a country that is trending in a more liberal direction, a more activist direction, and 58 being a base election where turnout is not going to be as high. Voters vote their more underlying party position rather than their presidential preference position.
I think that
sort of leads to that.
It's a very good point. I think there's a tendency on the part of historians to try to personify midterms as a report card on the president. But when you go back in time and you had more party discipline, I think you saw, as Kerry suggests, a return to the base party, the values that you believed in, and less concern about the presidential candidate who's in office.
Yeah, I think the turnout difference is really a lot of what drives that. That voters who turn out in a presidential election, 30-some percent don't vote in the midterm elections. And so you have a very different composition of the more activist voters who tend to be more diehard Democrat and Republican. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you get the truer sense of what the district or state's party affiliations are.
If you just joined us, Kerry Covington with us at the University of Iowa, political scientist, Tim Walch, presidential historian, as we look at midterms in history on this election day. While you're on the point, Kerry, of turnout, as I mentioned at the outset, we could see a huge turnout for a midterm, 45 to 50% of eligible voters casting ballots. Perhaps a level not seen for decades in this country. Kerry, what does our time have in common with previous times where there have been large turnouts?
Well, the larger turnout in the midterms tended to be in the 50s and 60s. And actually back then, party activists would go out and do door-to-door mobilization. They'd knock on doors, get people to vote. When we get to the 1960s, especially into the 1970s, that phenomena declines and you get more television advertising. And people who have studied voter turnout have found that as party efforts to do the door-to-door, face-to-face mobilizing declined, so did voter turnout. I mean, the turnout in midterm elections is mirrored by a decline in the turnout in presidential elections as well. So it's sort of a systemic phenomenon, not a midterm phenomenon.
Let's go to the 1960s. We left off at the 1958 midterm election. Let's go to the 1960s. Kerry, what strikes you in there that you want to bring out as a midterm that is of import?
Well, I mean, the important midterm would be 1966, as Tim was referring to in the 1930s, when the Democrats won a overwhelming victory, the midterm is when you pay the price. And so in 1964, Johnson brought out a lot of voters to vote. Barry Goldwater was seen as being sort of out of step and too extreme. And so a lot of districts and a lot of states voted for Johnson and then went ahead and voted for Democratic members of Congress. And so that led to 1965, 1966, where you get the or on poverty and the Great Society programs passed. And 1966 then slammed the door on that when the country went back to its more normal partisan division, and the Democrats lost an enormous number of seats that traditionally would have been held by Republicans and which returned to the Republicans once Goldwater was no longer on the ballot. So 1966, Democrats lost 47 seats.
And this is in
That brings an end to the whole social activism.
Right, and this is in the aftermath of the Voting Rights Act of the Civil Rights Movement, Kerry?
Yeah, that's too soon. I mean, that's 1965, and so African-American turnout begins to rise in 66, but you're not going to really see any effects from that immediately. 66 is mostly just sort of snapping back to a more normal partisan distribution in Congress, and 64 was the precipitating event that led the Democrats to have a historically large majority.
Yeah, Kerry's absolutely right. In fact, I'm old enough to remember the 1966 elections and remember some of the press I was in high school at the time, graduated from high school in the first year of college, and there was a story after story on the death of the Republican Party. Could they recover? Because the election in 64 was so overwhelming for Lyndon Johnson, and it's the sort of burden of his success in 64, coupled with social activism and then the emerging war in Vietnam, that in effect returns the American people to a sense of normality, I guess, in 66, and the party recovers. I still think, as I recall, even though there's a change of 47 seats, that the Democrats maintain a majority in it's such an overwhelming, it was almost like a single party rule after the 64 elections. Mm-hmm. And it's quite frankly the case that because Johnson had such a large majority in both houses of Congress, and because he was such a master of legislative rules and procedure, that it allowed him to pass the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And it was an enormous accomplishment. But then, of course, he paid something of a price in 66.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, he's alluded to have said to his White House staff and policy advisors in late 65, early 66, was his argument was, what else do we have? Let's bring everything to this war now, because in November it's all going to go away. So he saw it coming. He knew the window was closing, and he acted accordingly.
Well, and there's an argument to be made, really, that a president in his first term really has only 2 years to get anything accomplished, because that second 2 years, we notoriously talk about Mitch McConnell saying that his job was to make sure that Barack Obama wasn't reelected. But the party out of power is going to make every effort in the first 2 years to make sure that the midterm that the president faces will see a loss of seats. And then they'll stymie the president for the second 2 years of his term. I mean, we saw that, with Herbert Hoover. By the election of 1930, his presidency essentially was over, because the economy had basically dictated that he wasn't going to be able to accomplish very much between 1931 and 1932.
Tim, do you have any statistics on how many midterms are setbacks for the sitting presidents?
You know, the story, or this election in 1826 that I talked about, there have been 47 midterm elections since 1826, and the overwhelming majority, over 40, the president who holds the White House loses seats in the House of Representatives. So the overwhelming trend, if history is any indication, is that no president should come into a midterm election expecting to gain seats, because only in 1934 and again in 1998, which was the second midterm for Bill Clinton, and in 2002, have we seen a net gain. And even somebody as popular as Barack Obama was in 2008, by 2010, he lost 63 seats. As he said, he got shellacked. So the bottom line is, presidential popularity and maybe even aspiration and goal doesn't necessarily dictate what the results of that midterm.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. But before we go to break, let's nudge up into 1970 to hear some archive tape here as well. 1970, of course, well, set the scene for us. We're going to hear a little bit of President Nixon speaking to voters in Vermont and New Jersey. This is a month before the 1970 midterm elections. Take us back here. We're in the throes of huge Vietnam protests, a country torn apart much as it is today, not over war, but we will hear in this clip, we have sort of Nixon trying to rally
right.
What he sees as patriots against the sort of leftist anti-war mob. Is that a correct characterization?
Well, in fact, what you have, of course, 1968, he barely wins the presidency. So, and here's a man who lost the presidency by a narrow margin in 1960. And whatever you think of Nixon's personality and his whole, retrospective on his career, he was concerned and apprehensive that he was going to, again, be shellacked in 1970. And in fact, I'm trying to think. They lost, only about 12 seats or so. That's not too bad.
Let's go back to hear Richard Nixon, then president, 1970, speaking to voters in Vermont less than a month before the 1970 midterm elections amid the protests of that time.
You hear them. You hear them night after night on your television, people shouting their obscenities about America and what we stand for. You hear those who shout against speakers and shout them down who will not listen. And you hear those who engage in violence. You hear those and see them who without reason kill policemen and injure them and the rest. And you wonder, is that the voice of America? And I say to you, it is not. It is a loud voice, but my friend, there is a way to answer. Don't answer with violence. Don't answer by shouting the same senseless words that they use, but answer in the powerful way that Americans have always answered. Let the majority of Americans speak up. Speak up on November 3rd. Speak up with your boots. That's the way to answer.
What do you hear in that archival clip from 1970, Kerry Covington?
Well, by his own standard, it was bad advice because the majority spoke and cost him seats in the House.
Right.
So wasn't a good strategy. I thought we were going to hear a line about the silent majority in that speech.
He talks about the majority. Give us some background on what he termed the silent majority for those who weren't around at that time. What was the silent majority?
Well, the argument about the silent majority was that most voters were satisfied with the direction the country was going in. They were satisfied with the conduct of the war in Vietnam, and that all of the media attention was to the conflict and the controversy and the activism and the violence, protesting, and that was giving an unrepresentative perspective on how Americans felt about the policies that Nixon was espousing. Nixon in 1970 was working his tail off to undo the programs of the Great Society, the War on Poverty. He tried to create work requirements for to receive welfare payments, for instance. He was trying to cut back the welfare programs in every way he could.
Go ahead. Finish up the sentence. We've got to take a break, though.
Well, he just got repudiated, that's all.
Okay. Kerry Covington will be with us in the second half hour along with Tim Walsh as we look at midterms in historical perspective. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with just a few minutes with more of River to River. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, tomorrow at this time, we'll be picking through the winners and the losers across the country and also here in Iowa. Tonight, I want to remind you, IPR is teaming up with NPR for live election night coverage starting at 7 p.m. this evening. I'll be hosting to bring you up-to-the-minute results. I'll be talking with our team of reporters across Iowa at the gatherings held by the candidates for governor, but also for the congressional candidates. So join us this evening right here at 7 p.m., coverage by NPR starting then, and Iowa polls closing at 9 p.m. We'll start to see results soon after that. Tune into Iowa Public Radio for up-to-minute results this evening. Tomorrow on this program, political scientist Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, along with her colleague at UNI, Chris Larimer, will be joining us to describe what the new realities are facing each of the major political parties. Of course, we won't know how different those realities are than the present. We'll talk about the new realities in Congress, in state governorships, including our own governorship, if there's a change there, and in the Iowa legislature. And you can share your take on the midterm results tomorrow over the noon hour. Today, a historical look back at midterms on this election day with Kerry Covington, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Tim Walch, Presidential Historian, formerly of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, working our way, through the decades up to the 1970s, where we left off there. We got crunched by our break, Kerry, when you were talking about Nixon. We had Nixon in a little speech from campaign speech in 1970. So this is interesting. Nixon, 1970, a setback in the midterms. Then we have the whole Watergate era. What else do you find interesting about the midterms of that time?
Well, the key midterm here is the 1974 Watergate midterm, and Democrats bring in 40 seats in the House. They gain, I think, four seats in the Senate. Those Democrats are often referred to as the Watergate babies, and you see a lot of liberal democratic activism coming out of the Democrats brought in during Watergate. Joe Biden was one of those. He came in the House, I think, in 1974, and that was another impetus for Democrats. I mean, Democrats at this point had been dealing with Republican presidents for 6 years, and so to gain these seats, I think, brought them some enthusiasm.
But even then, you know, you go from the 74 debacle to the election of 1976, and one might have presumed that the Democrats would have selected a very liberal candidate for the presidency. But of course, surprise, surprise, Jimmy Carter wins the Iowa caucuses and goes on to win the nomination, but only narrowly wins the presidency. And then, of course, the whole Carter administration, and then the by-election after the midterm election after that, is unsuccessful for Carter, leading up to, again, a return to Republican administration.
So Carter was not seen as a liberal nominee?
Carter, I think, was seen more as a centrist, first Southerner to succeed in winning the nomination in the, since I think Woodrow Wilson, if you count him as a Southerner. And Lyndon Johnson, yes, that is true. I was thinking Texas is west, but it's as much south as it is west. But at any rate, Carter, I think, faced a real challenge in 78 because of high expectations. He'd only won by a narrow margin, and I think he lost in 78. They lost about 15 seats, which isn't all that much, but it was generally a struggle for him thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Right. He was seen as the son of the South. I mean, he won most of the southern states, which was unusual for a Democrat to do by that point, and didn't govern that way. And I think that's what ushers in the moral majority in Ronald Reagan in 1980.
Right. And interestingly enough, it was Jimmy Carter, a Democrat, who was the first born-again Christian president, right? But then moniker then taken over by the Republicans after Carter. Was it during the Reagan period, Kerry?
Sure, yeah. It's the reaction to, I mean, that's one of the reasons Jimmy Carter is able to win the South, is he speaks sort of a Southern perspective on things, and calling yourself a born-again Christian is an important identity in the South, and that makes him authentic to Southern voters. But when they become disappointed in his presidency, you begin to see Republican candidates pick up that label and run with it, largely as a result of Jerry Falwell and Robertson and the others, and then forming the moral majority.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the beginning of the Reagan presidency. Of course, 1980, the presidential election that ushered in President Reagan. We want to get to an archive clip from 82. But before that, take us back to the early Reagan years, Tim.
Well, Reagan was a revolution. And, of course, a master communicator, a man who brought a Republican revolution back to the White House. And I think people had high expectations for the Reagan presidency. But even in the midterm elections in 82, the president lost seats. So the bottom line here is that presidential popularity may or may not have any impact at all on what the voters decide in the midterm elections.
So let's listen to this. Go ahead, Kerry, before we do.
Yeah, I was going to say, we tend to forget the economy was in terrible shape in 1979, 1980, 1981. Federal Reserve Board was cranking up interest rates to drive down inflation. My wife and I bought our first house and paid like 13.5% interest on the mortgage. And Reagan paid a price for that. He fell further faster in his public approval ratings in the first 18 months than any president since Gallup started polling back in the 30s. But he recovered as the economy recovered and so won a resounding victory in 1984. But in 1982, there's a good case to be made that if Reagan had been forced to run for re-election, he would have lost.
Let's listen to this little interesting clip of archive material from the 1982 midterms, the coverage there on the night when the results were coming in. Walter Cronkite of CBS News in this clip speaking with former Vice President Walter Mondale, election night 1982, as it began to look like Republicans weren't doing so well.
What do you think that will do to President Reagan's chances of staying the course through the next Congress?
I think the public is really voting rather decisively today to change that course. I think I've traveled this country more than anybody in the last 2 years, and it was clear to me that people were suffering, that they didn't think this policy was working, that they were concerned about other issues like the environment and Social Security, and that they wanted to change.
Okay, 1982. Did it? What kind of change did that bring about for the second 2 years of that first four-year term of Ronald Reagan?
Well, I think that Reagan was to some extent chastened. Kerry's absolutely right. He was at a low point in his presidency. As historians, we look back on the Reagan presidency and we polish it and burnish it, and there are plenty of historians and political pundits who see him as one of the great presidents of our time. But I think in 82, as Kerry suggested, and my wife and I also had a 13.5% mortgage, there's a loyal society of people who had 13% mortgages and were happy to get it because it was still going up. So with that kind of inflation, people were struggling, and the president, as effective as Reagan was as a communicator, he gave people confidence that he was going to be able to do something, but the economy did not respond in a command sense, and so Reagan paid the price in 1982. That having been said, as Kerry suggests, he worked hard at this, and by 84, when he's put up against Walter Mondale, that same Walter Mondale we heard, he crushed Mondale. So the bottom line is that a president can recover even if he has an abysmal midterm election and then run again successfully. And the same would be certainly true with President Obama after losing 63 seats or something like that.
And we want to hear President Obama in a minute, but to finish up with Reagan.
Yeah.
No, in 1986, talk about that a little bit, Kerry. So he wins in 84, Reagan does, comes back,
right,
has another midterm in 86. This is amidst the Ollie North and the Iran-Contra scandal, isn't it?
Right, yeah, and he loses seats again. He had control, his party controlled the Senate, but not the House for the first 6 years. And then in the midterm in 86, both the House and the Senate went to the Democrats. So that's when he lost those seats there. But actually, the public kind of gave him a pass on Iran-Contra. There was disapproval, but his approval ratings did begin to climb again. He was not really... You know, he pursued a strategy of get all the information out, don't hide it. He learned from Watergate, you know, the cover-up's worse than the crime. And so he was all on board with fully investigating Iran-Contra. He buried the Democrats in documents rather than withholding them. And so I think he wrote out the Iran-Contra scandal much more effectively than he might have if he'd have pursued a different strategy. But still, 86... second midterm, your party loses, and he had that happen to him as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Reagan's skill, too, was aside from the question of the midterm. So once he lost those seats and he accepted the reality that he wasn't going to control Congress or he was never going to have a congressional majority, He learned to work with Tip O'Neill, and in effect, the two men really became partners. I wouldn't say they were necessarily friends, but they came to appreciate what the other could do for the opposite, and so became effective at governance. So the real question is, after a midterm election where the party in the White House loses seats, do they try to run against the Congress then, or do they try to embrace the Congress and come up with something that's a more of a collaboration? And do the American people approve of it in the next presidential election?
The last 10 minutes with Tim Walsh, presidential historian, Kerry Covington, political scientist at the University of Iowa. And let's move into some, well, you mentioned at the outset here, very few times, at least 40 of 46 last midterms in the U.S. It has gone against the sitting president in Congress. One of the few times that it didn't, you mentioned, Tim, the 98. The Clinton is under this is past the impeachment, right? He's
right.
Crawling out
between
of that
impeachment and conviction.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Impeachment, but no conviction by the Senate. So Tim, start us off, and then Kerry, follow up with your thoughts on the 98. Midterm that defied expectations.
That's exactly right. I think in 98, the Clinton administration actually gained seats in the House. Small number. I think it was about five. Didn't. Senate stayed the same. But by all expectations, one would have presumed a second midterm election for a president of questionable popularity would have been a disaster for President Clinton. But he held his own. And I'd be curious if Kerry has any sense of why that's the case, because I can explain 34, I can explain 2002, but I've got no idea what's going on in 98.
Yeah, I think two things were going on. One was we were in the middle of the dot-com boom. The economy was going great guns, and the public was behind Clinton on that. And the second thing is public opinion was clearly indicating that the Republicans were overreaching by seeking impeachment and conviction. And so the signal being sent to the Republicans was, we don't want the president removed, and the Republicans weren't taking the sign, and so they lost seats in that election. I mean, you talk about a rare midterm election. There's only three, as Tim said, when the president's party gained seats. But this is the only one where it's a second-term president and he gained seats. It cost Newt Gingrich the speakership. Right. He ended up resigning because of all of the controversy of how could you lose this election. This was a gimme for the Republicans, and they lost ground.
Mm-hmm. So it is extremely rare in your first term to lose. Then the rarest of all was Clinton one time, you say. One time
unique.
That a second-term president has not lost seats in the midterm.
Gained seats.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing. He's gaining seats, about five seats or so. It's not a lot. But you would have expected him to lose, as Barack Obama did in his first midterm election, you know, dozens of seats. But he didn't.
Between 54 and 2014, the average second-term seat loss was 25. So to go up 5 instead of down 25 is incredibly unusual.
Okay. Well, we've mentioned him several times this hour. Let's get to that midterm, the first midterm that Barack Obama faced as president, to give you a sense of what that was like in 2010. Here's a clip from the PBS program Washington Week a few days after the 2010 midterm elections. It features, you'll hear voices of Sarah Palin, then a newcomer on the political scene, but also you'll hear familiar voices from today, Mitch McConnell, Obama's voice, Nancy Pelosi, John Boehner. Let's listen to a little bit of this little preview from Washington Week from PBS 2010.
I'm confident and I am hopeful because this is our movement. This is our moment. This is our morning in America.
Tuesday's election was not about Republicans. It was about the Democrats. They got a report card. They got an F.
I'm not recommending for every future president that they take a shellacking like I did last night. You know, I'm sure there are easier ways to learn these lessons.
No regrets.
No regrets, because we believe we did the right thing.
There seems to be some denial on the part of the president and other Democrat leaders.
The winners, the losers, and the new faces.
Okay, well, Washington a Week from PBS in 2010. Interesting to hear those voices and that word that stands out. Obama picked shellacking. Nobody forgets that word.
I want to say, I think it brought shellac back as a coating to be used on wood and other products because I dare say it's not used very much in any other context.
Okay, so in 2008... Senator Obama elected to be president, seen then in 2008 as a post-political, post-partisan president, and then he falls from those heights to lose 63 seats in the House. Tim, how?
Well, high expectations. I think the controversy over the Affordable Care Act. I think just a general dissatisfaction with the progress of the previous 2 years. But again, I'm always mystified when you've got a president who's essentially popular and a real dramatic change in the number of seats in the particularly the House of Representatives. And as we see this in 58, and we see this in a number of other elections where you've got a popular president, but you also have local decisions that are being made in part, too. You know,
But when we look at President Trump's popularity now, isn't it pretty much Kerry equal to President Obama's when we aggregate the polls?
His approval ratings are below any other president in a midterm election, as far as I understand. And so you'd expect his party to lose seats this time around. Again, the norm is around 20 seats, 21 seats. So the question for the Democrats is if they can boost that up to the number they need to get a majority.
Mm-hmm. So what is your read on that 2010 election, Kerry, when you look back at what caused the dramatic loss in the House?
Well, I want to introduce an idea we haven't talked about yet, and you contrast it to the Tip O'Neill, who Tim mentioned. Tip O'Neill used to say that all politics is local, but now we talk about wave elections, and a wave election is when the nation is overtaken by an issue, and local politics is pushed aside, and you vote on some major national issue. 2010 was a prime example of that, where this is the birth of the Tea Party. They storm Democratic members of Congress's town hall meetings. They organize, and they really whipped up on the Democrats in 2010. And it was a national issue. It was a repudiation of the Affordable Care Act. You have to remember that until Obama left office, the Affordable Care Act was underwater. It was more people opposed it than supported it.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay. So let's finish up this hour by perhaps a comment. With all this historical knowledge that we've gained over the hour from the two of you, what can be said? Well, it's clear that any president who even loses maybe seats in the single digits in the House
yes,
of Representatives can claim victory,
yeah.
Tim?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I mean, the point is, if he were to hold the majority in the House as well as the Senate,
even
the expectation,
losing 20 seats would be a victory.
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly by comparison with the past, because as you say, over 40 of those 47 elections since 1826 have seen a loss of substantial numbers of seats for the president in power. You know, it's also true that there's so many other factors at play in any combination of elections, because you still do have, as Kerry alluded to, you have some local issues and you have some regression to the base, the local party, and the quality of the candidate. So in any particular district, whether it's a House district or a Senate district or running for the state legislature or whatever, you've got so many different factors that can affect any particular race. And that's what's unusual. You don't have that generally speaking, you don't have that overwhelming either affirmation or evaluation of the president. You've got local issues. And as to repeat exactly what Kerry has said, all politics is local, and we certainly see it here in Iowa as elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. To finish up here, Kerry, we have to ask, you know, this president, the current president, has broken so many conventions, is so far from the norm in a lot of ways in his unconventional approach to the presidency. Is it worth asking how much of this historical context even applies to President Trump?
Well, what's important about what Trump is doing is he's making it a wave election. He's saying it's all about me. He's making a point out of immigration. And he's asking voters to vote accordingly. the higher rates of turnout are going to work against him, because we know that as the rate of turnout increases, you get disproportionately larger groups of Democratic voters, whereas in a low turnout midterm, you get disproportionately large numbers of Republican voters. So he's making this bet that he can turn this into a wave election and create a red wave. And if he succeeds, then he'll have broken another convention that all us political scientists will have to go back and try to figure out. But at this point, I think all the signs indicate that the Republicans are going to lose control of the House. That just looks like what's most likely to happen here.
We've run out of time. A fascinating hour with you, Kerry Covington, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. And as always, Tim Walsh, Presidential Historian, former Director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. We could talk about this all afternoon. Thank you for spending the hour with us, gentlemen.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Live coverage tonight. IPR and NPR teaming up for light and live election coverage starting at 7 p.m. We hope you'll tune in. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Caitlin Harrop. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Hope to join you again this evening for our live election coverage.